Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Morning, Matt.
Morning, Stu.
I'm pretty excited because, you know what, Nehemiah for a very long time, probably 30 plus years, has been one of my favourite books of the
really?
Bible.
Yeah. Yeah. What is it about? What is it
Look,
about
I think it's about his ability, I don't want to get ahead here, but it's his ability to cast a vision and align everyone with that vision.
Yeah, it is pretty remarkable, actually.
There's been, I don't know how many leadership books written about Nehemiah, but it's a pretty amazing achievement.
Yeah.
And in the time frame, you know, it's like we're not talking 5 years to shift the culture and, you know, it's like, man, he just got it done.
Yeah.
You know?
And the pressure is amazing, isn't it? Like the opposition that he faces through here. It's an amazing story, actually. It's been great reading it again and getting down into some of the details. And the more that I've done that, the more I realize, man, this is actually remarkable what happens here in such a short time to do what they did.
Totally.
And to deal with a whole lot of other issues under, you know, pretty significant opposition.
Welcome, listeners. We better draw you into our conversation. You're with Thrive Deeper, and we're moving into the book of Nehemiah today. And I think important to recognize here that the book of Nehemiah actually happens after the events of Esther, even though the book of Esther comes after the book of Nehemiah in our Bible. Esther, you'll recall with our last podcast, became the queen of Persia, a very powerful position under King Xerxes. And this story of Nehemiah happens after that.
Mm.
And interesting to see, I think, how God's provision through Esther flows into Nehemiah, because, of course, Artaxerxes is Xerxes' son.
Yeah.
Xerxes was married to Esther.
Yeah.
Esther was probably only maybe 16 to 20 when she married. She would have been 45 and probably still around and possibly even still queen if Artaxerxes hadn't married.
Yeah.
Not his wife, but the queen. Yeah. And we don't know whether the queen mentioned here is Esther, but she would have certainly had influence still.
Yeah.
And now we've got this Nehemiah, another Jew, and you can kind of see God's favor has gone beyond just the story of Esther and flowing in to the story of Nehemiah. So it's pretty, a pretty powerful kind of testimony to God's provision, you know, and providence throughout history, really.
Yeah, it's great. So we're in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, which is about 445.
Yep.
And this
which is about 30 years after the Esther story.
Yeah, that's right. And this is 13 years after. So the story of Nehemiah is set 13 years after Ezra's arrival in Jerusalem.
That's right.
So he's already there.
And he was with the first group that sort of went back to, in a sense, attempt to rebuild the temple. And we know that they came across a lot of resistance from the neighbors. Those neighbors wrote letters to the king.
Yeah.
Of course, the king did the research and figured out that there had been a decree for them to do it. So they started again, but the place was still pretty much in
that's
ruin.
Right.
And the neighbors were still pretty anti.
Yeah. And there'd been a few governors already up to then. I mean, Ezra is a scribe and a priest.
Yes.
He hasn't been the governor.
No, that's right.
But Nehemiah actually is going to come and take, in a sense, he's authorized to sort of take charge in a sense, ultimately. So, he's going to bring a difference the way that he's going to, you know, govern. I mean, I think he's going to be a real example of some very biblical principles, which is partly what this story is about.
Yeah. So, of course, it begins, we've got Nehemiah, who was the cupbearer to the king, just to give a bit of context. And, of course, this is in Susa, which is, of course, where Esther was as well. As we know, that's where the Persian king was. Now, a cupbearer was a pretty important position. It's not just the guy, you know, it's not the sommelier who just pours the wine and disappears. In a sense, the cupbearer was really probably largely around protection for the king, because poisoning was a very common way of getting rid of kings you didn't like.
Yeah.
And so you had to have someone who you knew was giving you something safe to drink, you know, just from a drink point of view. But I'm sure it would have been much more as a counsel, someone that the king would have leant on for advice or what do you think about this?
Yeah, so it's not just at the sort of lowly servant
that
stands off to the side
with a white napkin over his shoulder. And
yeah, that's right. So this is not just the butler. It was actually quite a privileged position. And the you know, the cupbearer was also an official. I know it's hard for us to sort of imagine that, Stu, because we just think, oh, this is just like the butler and what's so special about that.
Yeah.
But you've got constant access to the king, and particularly for a Persian king, you know, like the story in Esther where she's not even allowed to come into his presence unsummoned. Well, the cupbearer is always there with him, and he has this ability to speak to the king. And in fact, the way that the king interacts here with Nehemiah, I think, shows a level of
intimacy in their relationship.
Yeah, that's right.
Totally.
But look, there's a little bit of, I think, interesting background here too, because the years immediately before this had actually been quite difficult in 460 BC. So remember, we're working backwards. So 445 is when this story begins. But 15 years earlier, there was this revolt in Egypt that wasn't actually quelled until 455.
So this is a revolt against the Persian Empire?
Yeah, that's right.
That was
right,
the ruling empire at the time? Yep.
Yeah. And then in 448, one of the satraps of that region actually rebelled. I mean, it was later reconciled to the king. But the thing is, at this point, because of all of that, the king of Persia, I think he would have wanted to have had loyal supporters Jerusalem in the case of more trouble with Egypt. Because you've got to remember, you've got to go through Jerusalem, through that region to get down to Egypt, right? So I think he wants a stable and loyal situation there in Egypt. So I think that's, again,
feeding into
there's
this.
Sort of providential circumstances around this as well.
Yeah.
And so this is partly what's behind, you know, there's a bit of politics playing into his responses to Nehemiah. Anyway, so the story begins. Nehemiah's brother, Hanani, comes all the way from Susa. I mean, this is a massive journey that he comes
to Susa from Jerusalem.
Yes, comes to Susa. That's right, from Jerusalem. So
he'd gone with the first bunch with Ezra and the likes, and then he
comes back to see Nehemiah. This is probably, you know, it's probably a diplomatic mission. I think he's wanting to bypass the officials of Samaria due to this hostility. They want to bring word back because the Samaritans, as we're going to see, are going to want to do everything to try to
stop the rebellion
or make the Jews seem like they're rebellious whatever.
It's more of the same that we saw in the book of Ezra.
Yeah, that's right. So they've come back to sort of directly appeal. And you know, Hanani knows that Nehemiah has this position as well. So he's wanting to
let's go
sort
past
of leverage
the gatekeepers
that.
And go straight to the guy who talks to the king.
Yeah, that's right. So it says in Nehemiah 1 from verse 3-4, it says, they said to me, so they bring back this report. They said to me, those who survived the exile back in the province, and they're in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire. Now, certainly the walls from the original destruction probably hadn't been fully repaired, or it's quite possible that if they had, that the Samaritans maybe had pulled those down.
Yeah.
There seems to be something fresh about this, so maybe there was some attempt at some earlier stage to rebuild, but that had been pulled down again. And so it says in verse 4, when I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. And what you get here, I mean, again, this is interesting because it's one of these great recorded prayers that we have. Mm. And these are important because they're model, you know, these are model moments for us, model moments of prayer. And it's interesting here again, you know, we've noticed this in Ezra, how he prays and he confesses the sins of his people going back generations as though they were personally his. You know,
Look what they've done and sorry for what they did.
That's right. It's very much the situation that we are in. So he prays and he confesses his sins and those of his people. And I think this is remarkable. It's worth looking at that at that prayer. And then this is where it notes, actually, at this point in chapter 1, I was cupbearer to the king.
Yeah, it's just one little sentence.
It's one little sentence, but I think it's significant. There's just a note here from the New International Commentary on the Old Testament, one of the best commentaries on Nehemiah. It says, recent studies have shown the importance of this position. In the ancient Near Eastern court, the cupbearer with his direct access to the king was regarded as important and influential. In Tobit, which is a book, another sort of traditional book from that period. It is said that Esarhaddon's cupbearer was second only to him in his kingdom. In Herodotus, it is stated that Cambyses, who was another one of the Persian emperors, did one of his friends a favor by appointing his son as a cupbearer, right? So that's, this is a favorable position. For Nehemiah to have reached this position was an important achievement. It shows what influential position some of the Jews of the exile had reached. Another important point is that Nehemiah as cupbearer quite probably had been a eunuch. It's an interesting point. Men in the service of the king who came in contact with the king's harem were usually eunuchs. So just another interesting point there.
And again, that was probably so that they couldn't, try to challenge the king and have kids who could take over the rule and all those sorts of things. So it was about control, really.
And I think this is an issue for Nehemiah too. I mean, he goes on to say, you know, so Nehemiah was not only from the Jewish laity, but he was also a eunuch. Now, for a Jewish person, that's kind of a problem, you know, because in a sense, he's... Even in Jewish thought, he's disqualified from a lot of things, you know, and unfortunately.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is in comparison, you know, with Ezra, who was a priest and, you know, had this sort of high position. Nehemiah's position amongst his own people would have
been a bit tenuous.
That's right, would have been quite tenuous, which is what it makes him even more remarkable in a sense, because he has to win this. He can't. Yeah. You know, he can't just appeal to any sort of traditional position.
And we'll see later in the story that the enemies try to use this situation for Nehemiah to trap him and to trick him.
Exactly.
And
yeah,
we'll
that's
that,
right.
We'll see that come a bit later.
So as we go into chapter 2, so and here's where the story begins. So Nehemiah's serving the king, and the king notices him looking upset, right, because he's received this news. And, you know, there's a lot of, look, they've put a lot of hope in this is the restoration. So this is something remarkable that's happened, right?
Yeah.
And it's happened already. That this is decades old now, but this is remembered as something remarkable, you know. Mm. But he's discouraged to hear that, you know, the walls are burnt down, that this is the
so
case.
This is the follow-on from him weeping and praying to God and crying out to God. And then the king obviously notices that.
And the king cares.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
This is interesting, isn't it?
But the fact that the king even notices.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, mate, what's wrong? You seem a bit flat, you know.
See,
like,
kings don't do this.
No,
I mean,
that's just right. Some pastors
kings
don't even
care.
Do that.
thanks, Stu. It's okay. So. I think there's a moment. I think the text wants us to see, because I think people in those days, they know that kings don't usually do this. And there's this theme of God's people finding favor, you know, that sense.
Yeah. Let me read chapter 2, verses 2 to 6, because this is what Nehemiah says when the king asks him that question. He says, I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? So then the king said to me, what is it you want? Which is also unusual for a king.
And I love this next bit.
Yeah, I do too. Then I prayed to the God of heaven and I answered the king.
I love that, because notice
he didn't
before
just go,
he speaks to the king,
he's praying.
He speaks to the real king.
Yeah, totally. And I think there's a pattern we see later as well, which we'll come to, where that's even further enforced. But anyway, then I prayed to the God of heaven and I answered the king, if it pleases the king and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried so that I can rebuild it. Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, which is an interesting comment, which is why
it is,
I kind of raised
the
issue about whether maybe that was Esther,
asked
me, how long will your journey take? And when will you get back? It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time.
Pretty bold request.
Oh, totally. Well, he goes beyond that. It's like, oh, and by the way, can I take?
Well, I mean, it's amazing because he makes the further request that he makes. First of all, is letters to the governors of the region.
Right.
I mean,
he's
got to pass through.
Yep.
Look, this is a dangerous journey, isn't it? And so he's got to pass through these regions. So he wants letters at a safe passage.
So you remember possibly with Ezra. Ezra didn't want to ask for letters because he wanted to give witness to the king that God was, you know. So similar situation here.
Yeah.
And Nehemiah saying, I want letters
That's
to get
right.
through.
And, and the Samaritan governor probably would not have even let him through otherwise. And then second, he asked for a letter of introduction to Asaph, who's the chief forester. I mean, this is a really bold, request. This the chief forester to provide him with timber for his building activities.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's clearly a sense in which he's thought this through already. He's not just making this up as he goes along, because he's able to answer quite quickly and sort of unfurl a bit of a plan.
And this timber would have come from Judah, because that was part of the Persian Empire. It's not like they had to lump the timber all the way down from Susa to, it was just like giving him permission to access the timber that was owned by the...
Probably from Lebanon, in fact. Yeah.
Yeah.
And probably, you know, he would have understood the need from Hanani and so forth. So, man, I think it's possible that the king was even probably impressed at how organized and specific his response was. It wasn't just a vague response.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, wow, you know, he's really thought this through.
Yep.
So, and this is the interesting thing. He actually gives him more than what he asked.
Yeah, that's right.
And this is this theme of favor. You know, he's finding favor. And so the king not only gives him all of that, but he sends cavalry with him. You know, that's pretty remarkable. So, and certainly Nehemiah would not have dared to ask for that much. So here you see this favor, God showing favor. And that's what I think we need to see.
Now, of course, word gets back to the nations surrounding, you know, Judah and the rulers of those nations. And this is where we hear about Sanballat and Tobiah, and we're going to hear soon about Third. And they're fairly, or very, these aren't, you know, just local blokes.
Yeah.
These are governors, rulers of surrounding
peoples. Geshem is the Geshem, the Arab.
And extremely powerful. Who completely surround and really don't like the idea of there being another, the Jews coming back. And, you know, they've probably got to the point where they feel like, oh, we've got control of the situation here now, and we're going to look after, keep these Jews subdued, the ones that are already back in and probably that's part of the burning of the wall and the destruction, the destruction. It's like, let's just keep intimidating these people and keeping them down. They find out about this, and we read in chapter 2, verse 10, when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about this, they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites.
Yeah, and I think in the biblical text too, you're meant to note that. So something, so their schemes are getting thwarted. That's why they're upset, you know. And so that's a sort of a sign that God is showing favor, but it's also stirring up, that, you know, it's stirring up some stuff here. Yeah. And so this is going to lead to a bit of a showdown as we move
forward. And it's, in a sense, it's a bit of a repeat of the pattern, you know. If we look even just back to the Esther story, but you can go way back before that, they think they've kind of got the sorted and they've got the control of the Israelites and they're keeping them subdued, but God's actually going to completely flip that.
Yeah, that's
right. Which is exactly what happened with Esther. And
that's right. So Nehemiah arrives in Jerusalem and he actually goes out during the night to inspect the walls. I think he's
probably trying to fly under the radar a little bit, I would imagine, with the enemies around, not
give
them a bit of a heads up.
Well, it becomes clear that they have spies inside the city. So he doesn't want to prematurely sort of provoke anything here. So he goes out at night and he's basically assessing how much needs to be done.
And that's kind of when the mocking begins, because obviously, as you say, Sanballat and Tobiah and...
But they do actually hear about it.
They got spies.
Yeah, that's right, because they've got spies. And so they, as you said, they begin to mock. And the sort of...
Angle they take.
The angle they take, oh, you're trying to rebel. Because that's the ultimate... If they can get that rumor out to the king, then, you know, that's pretty powerful.
And particularly given what had happened with Egypt just recently. It's like, it's the last thing the king needs.
And then in 2:20, you know, it says, this is Nehemiah, I answered them by saying, the God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it. So again, this is constantly pointing out who he's trusting in.
Yeah.
And this is noted throughout the text because the odds are against him. But this is showing us, this is a man of faith. Who believes he's doing what needs to be done, and that's what he's focusing on. He's going to do that what needs to be done, and he's going to trust God for the rest.
I actually think there's something even more, because immediately to me, I'm thinking, what would I have said? I would have said, oh, no, the king sent us to do this.
Yeah.
But he doesn't go to the king. He doesn't go. Yeah. He doesn't say it's the king.
Yeah.
He wants to make, because he knows this is going to happen.
Yeah.
He wants the glory to be to God, and so he only talks about it being God. Because I would have pulled out a note and gone, oh, hang on, no, the king sent us, and you guys are the ones that are an issue here.
Yeah.
He never even mentions the fact that the king released him, resourced him, and sent him. You know, it's like...
That's great.
Ever.
Yeah.
You know, so it's amazing.
Yeah. So the work begins in earnest, and chapter 3 gives us a summary of who did what. And just another note here from, this is from the Word Biblical Commentary. We're struck first by the unity of intention, which is here displayed. Some 40 or more sections are mentioned in the list. Most of them, we must suppose, work simultaneously.
Yep.
This, it should be remembered, excludes extensive areas where a completely new line for the wall was being followed. Moreover, we learn in the next chapter that the work was done sufficiently quickly to take Sanballat by surprise. This undoubtedly testifies to a remarkable feat of organization and leadership, though nothing is said directly about that in the text. So, and we've got to remember, Nehemiah is the one writing the text. So he's being very sort of understated about actually the sort of element of you know, leadership achievement that's at work here as
well. But also just being able to cast a vision and bring unity, because let's remember everybody there would have been looking after their own kind of patch.
Yeah.
And, you know, not necessarily disunity, but certainly not focused on a common purpose, focused on their own purpose of survival and getting things done. And Nehemiah draws them together and says, no, there's a bigger thing than just you. There's the us.
Yeah,
and this is what we need to do to get this done. And the fact that the work was complete, I mean, quickly is an understatement, really. We're talking about a fairly significant wall. Well, you've probably seen it, but it's a fairly significant wall around the city of Jerusalem in 52 days.
Yeah. It's amazing.
I mean,
yeah, it is a large area. I mean, there's nothing of, well, I mean, there are sections actually of that wall that you can see that have been excavated. But it's a large area. It's a very big job. And I think the point that you make is a really good one, because essentially spiritual leadership, and this is not just political leadership, this is spiritual leadership very much. Yeah. And that is very much about calling people out from their individualistic concerns and focusing on the us. Mm. Okay, there's an us here, and that is the great challenge of leadership. And you know, that it's that sense of that common purpose and rallying people around that. And he does a great job. But of course, as soon as this happens, there's significant opposition to the rebuilding, and we read about this in chapter 4. Stu, have you got?
Yeah, I have. Let me read that for you. When Sanballat, so again, one of the surrounding nations' governors or leaders, heard that we were rebuilding.
He seems to be the key one, doesn't he?
He does, and I think
that's a bit of the ringleader.
Yeah, and also Tobiah a little later because of his connections inside.
Oh, he's got, that's right. Yeah, he's got connections.
When Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. He ridiculed the Jews, and in the presence of his associates and the army of Samaria, he said, "What are those feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring the stones back to life from those heaps of rubble, burned as they are?" Tobiah the Ammonite, who was at his side, said, "What they are building, even a fox climbing up on it would break down their wall of stones."
It's, you know, this sort of mocking, and this is a theme, you know, throughout scripture. It's like Goliath mocking the Israelites. Yeah. It's you know, even in the Psalms, you know, one of the things that's cited as an appeal, you know, that my enemies mock me, you know. So this mocking is meant to be this discourager, and it's almost, it becomes this thing that sort of activates the covenant promises in a way. Once the enemies start mocking and saying, "You can't, it's not going to happen."
Yeah.
It's the thing that sort of activates faith. It's the Assyrians during the time of Hezekiah saying, "What do you reckon? Do you seriously think that God is going to save you? No God of any nation has ever been able to stand in our way." And it's the mocking that tends to be this sort of covenant activator. And so you see this, it's amazingly consistent throughout scriptures.
And even for Jesus.
Oh, isn't it true? That's a good one.
The mocking of Jesus. And in fact, ultimately he has the victory.
During the crown of thorns while he's on the cross. Yeah,
save yourself.
Right through.
You know,
exactly.
Can I just say here too, this brings into focus a little bit the understanding of why the Samaritans, when we look in Jesus's time, were so kind of despised by the Jewish, because of all of this history.
Yeah.
You know? And so you think about the Good Samaritan story, you think about the fact that even Jesus's first extensive missional time was spent in a Samaritan village for 4 days.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, hang on, this is the enemy.
That
kind of gives a bit of context around where that historical kind of hatred has come.
And it's interesting to underline this idea of this mocking being sort of this covenant activator.
Yeah.
That's where you have Nehemiah inserting the prayer. Where you have the list of the mocking. And it's the same with the story of Hezekiah. Like, he gets that letter and then that he goes to prayer, right? He takes the letter with all the mockery in it and he lays it out before the Lord, right? And
interesting though, before we read that prayer, Jesus's prayer on the cross in contrast was, "Forgive them for what they do." This prayer, he says, "Hear us, O God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads. Give them over as plunder in a land of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in the face of the builders."
Which is a legitimate prayer out of, you know, Genesis 12, "Those who curse you will be cursed."
Totally.
But this, I mean, it does show the difference, you know, when Jesus is being mocked, because he is the one that is paying to flip that on its head, and allow the curse to be blessed. I mean, there's a principle of justice here. There's a covenant principle here, and he's, you know, validly praying that. And, you know, and we'll see it does. It lands on their own heads. Anyway, so the builders get halfway, and it seems from the text that while there's some triumph in this, the initial enthusiasm seems to be wearing thin.
So we're about, let's just assume we're about halfway through. We're at the sort of the 26 to 28 day mark.
Yeah.
You know, life was pretty tough. It wasn't like easy. And the men were all building this wall, which means they're not earning a lot
exactly.
of money.
Yeah.
I think there's a mention that there was a bit of a famine going on. And so there was a shortage of food. And it's like, you know, we need to get back and attend to our own lives rather than the us aspect of things.
Yeah,
and
that's
so
right.
This is where Nehemiah again kind of recasts the vision really and draws everyone back together.
Yeah. And also, It's not just the discouragement and the hardship, but they know that they're surrounded by enemies and they're facing the prospect of being attacked and actually probably their work being torn down. And that may well have happened before.
Yeah, totally.
You know, so it's not a very encouraging. So, man, I mean, Nehemiah's got his work cut out for him here.
Yeah.
So they send these threatening messages, you know, 4 verse 12 in response to those messages. Says, then the Jews who live near them came and told us 10 times over, wherever you turn, they will attack us. So not only are they sending message, but these, you know, other people are saying, what are you doing? You're crazy.
Yeah. And partly probably that was because there was some spies inside who were trying to sow in underneath Nehemiah. This is a bad idea. We lived in peace before we started doing this.
And
war.
Fear spreads.
Totally.
I mean, you know, this fear is spreading like a wildfire. So he's got a massive leadership challenge. As builders are close to desertion here. So Nehemiah stations some of the people on the lowest parts of the wall with weapons. He addresses the people, you know, 4 verse 14, don't be afraid of them. And this is important. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome. Remember, right? And now the Samaritans decide at this point.
They're going to back off a bit.
That's
here.
Right. They're going to back off because he's stationed guards. And
well, I think also they were thinking that they could surprise them and clearly – obviously, Nehemiah
or at least discourage them.
As well. But Nehemiah got an inside running and it's like, oh, suddenly they're, you know, the element
that's
of surprise
that's
is gone.
Right. So they've lost the element of surprise.
Yeah.
They've also not been able to sort of frighten them away
Scare
from
them
the
off,
project,
exactly.
which they've not wanted to do. So, I mean, they don't really want all-out war.
No, they don't.
It's
kind of the first kind of Cold War, probably, isn't it? Really, it's like who can rattle the saber the loudest, and yet no one really wants to fight. But
that's right. So
they continue to work, and now Nehemiah's got some of the guys with a sword in one hand and a trowel or a spade or whatever it is in the other hand, building the wall. And
there's
this kind of picture of vigilance right around the wall. He sets up systems of communication. Yeah. And so on. So
that's right.
We're moving to chapter 5.
Chapter 5. Well, the next problem that Nehemiah has to deal with is the problem of the poverty. I mean, talk about problem upon problem. And this is because while the walls, as you said, while the walls are being built, I mean, everything else is sort of falling, is being neglected. So, you know, this is exacerbated by the fact that most of the men are building the wall have probably got money loans. And so there's this issue. There are issues internally of people having borrowed money, being charged excessive interest, which should never have been the case.
This is internally loaning, but also there would have been the taxes to Persia that they had to pay.
Yeah, that's right.
And all that kind of stuff. And those that had were probably having more, and those that didn't have were having less.
Yeah. And these financial problems for the families there, I mean, they're really big problems because the last resort was that you sell your children into slavery. Oh. And this, you know, this is evidently happening, you know, for the suggestion.
But charging usury to your brothers, like interest, was forbidden.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So in a sense, perhaps Nehemiah, and it's interesting that Nehemiah even confesses that he had been doing the same thing and sets the example by saying, I'm not going to.
Well, his family, yeah.
Like, his family. I mean,
that's right, because he's got his family estate and he's, you know, discovered that, man, like no one's hands are clean here.
Yes.
Yeah. So there's this... He's actually furious. Like he's furious at this. Like, you know, I'm trying to rebuild. We're trusting God. You guys, you're doing fundamentally the wrong thing.
Why is God going to honor us when you're
charging excessive interest to your brothers when they can't pay back? You're forcing them to sell their kids into slavery. You know, he in 5 verse 8, he says to the people, as far as possible, we have bought back our fellow Jews who were sold to the Gentiles. Now you are selling your own people only for them to be sold back to, you know, I mean, so, as you said, he's also kind of, he's not exempting himself to that. He's modeling repentance. So we learn in chapter 5, verse 14, that Nehemiah had actually been appointed governor. We don't really know that until this point. Yeah. So to set an example, he forgoes the privileges and opportunities of this position. So because he finds this very problematic situation where people are exploiting people, probably past governors have really milked that position for their own benefit. He's going to actually forego this. And this is amazing. Bit of leadership here, you know, leading by example.
So when we talk about forego this, and it'll come a little bit later around food and stuff, of course, the governor would have been entitled to have the landowners bring food to supply his table.
Yep.
And basically saying, I didn't ask them to do any of that. They could keep the food for their own families feed their own families. I didn't ask them to do any of that. So that's what he's kind of foregoing in some way. He's saying, no, I'm going to look after myself so that you guys can keep all of your produce, for want of a better word.
Yeah, yeah. And actually add to this, he's then entertaining up to 150 officials. I mean, that's partly why those food supplies are brought in, because the governor is constantly entertaining a number of officials, but he's doing that from his own estate pretty much. So, yeah.
And then a really interesting line at 5:19, remember me with favor, my God, for all I have done for these people.
That's right.
Reading that, and it's interesting when I think about all the books that have been written about Nehemiah, you know, on leadership thing. I don't think it's remember me as in, you know, chalk up a gold star for when I get, you know, to heaven.
Yeah.
I think it's more let this be remembered, because this is a model for how we unite around common purpose and we all move forward. You know?
Yeah, that's right. And it's, I mean, it's also an appeal. Lord, I've done the right thing and I'm trusting you to take this somewhere.
Yeah,
you know, that remember me is always a sort of an appeal for sort of further favor around that work. So it's not, he's not looking for personal reward as just, Lord, continue to bless my efforts here.
Yeah. Which means bless your people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Anyway, so the walls are built.
52 days.
Yeah, that's right. It's an amazing achievement. And except for the gates, they're still to be completed. This is when, I mean, Sanballat and his mates now, they are going to target Nehemiah himself. And
so remember again, listeners, Sanballat and
Geshem and Tobiah.
They're, you know, really powerful leaders of the nations or the peoples surrounding Jerusalem at this point in time.
And they realize this guy, actually, this is a great leader. He's been able to do this in such a short amount of time. They now realize, okay, we need to assassinate this guy.
Yeah.
And so they invite him to some meeting and they're going to ambush him. He's not stupid.
No.
He realizes, and so he just makes excuses not to come. Just a note here from, again, a word biblical commentary. From Sanballat's point of view, Nehemiah himself was the chief stumbling block to peace.
And peace he's talking about is peace where we dominate.
Oh, that's right.
People,
yeah, that's right.
You just do what we tell you to do. Yeah.
That's right. Because it goes on to say, prior to his coming, relations between Samaria and Jerusalem were on an excellent footing. You know, they were sort of docile.
Yeah, that's
right. Yeah. And now they're no longer docile. You know, Tobiah had succeeded well in getting himself accepted in Jerusalem.
And that was largely due to intermarrying.
Yeah, that's
which
right.
Which we'd heard Ezra was trying to deal
with
previously, but obviously it had picked up again.
And it emphasizes the importance of that problem.
Totally.
Like, yeah, exactly. So now Nehemiah had arrived with his blatantly separatist and aggressive politics. If one could eliminate him, good relationships from their point of view could be restored. So they're trying to make this people docile to their wishes. But, you know, Nehemiah, they really see as the problem here. Well, so look, when he can't get Nehemiah to fall into his ambush, Sanballat turns to accusing him, interestingly, via an unsealed letter.
Well, he'd already sent about five of these letters saying the same thing. And this time he sent it again.
And the idea is it leaks out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's emphasized that it's an unsealed letter because all along the way, he wants to ensure that it can be pulled out and everyone can read it.
Which means it gets back to the king and the letter's talking about the fact that he's plotting against the king.
That's
and yet
right.
Nehemiah still doesn't say, the king actually sent me. He never says that.
Yeah.
That would have been the perfect defense. You could say what you want, but hey,
that's right.
I'm here on the king's work.
Yeah. I mean, he doesn't really pull that lever.
He points to God.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, God gets the glory because again, if you remember at that moment, before he answered the king, what do you want?
Yeah.
He asked God.
Yeah.
And God said, this is what you have to ask for.
And in a sense, the rumour has some power behind it, because rebuilding walls, remember, you're building the walls of a fortified city, and that could definitely make you suspect. So there's some, it gives some credibility to this rumour. Yep. Yeah, that's right. And then they start to use even Nehemiah's own people against him. And we've pointed out before that there would have been people in Jerusalem who opposed Nehemiah. And these guys could certainly be leveraged. Mm. So they come up with this shrewd plan, right? We're going to hire a false. This is a really shrewd plan. I mean, they're really trying everything to get Nehemiah, or to sort of
trap him, really.
To trap him, and to try and undermine his leadership. So what they do is that they hire a false prophet to tell Nehemiah to take refuge from assassins
in the temple.
In the temple, right. Mm. And there's the New International Commentary is a note here. It says Nehemiah, as a layman, was not allowed to enter the temple.
Yeah. Because remember, he was a eunuch.
That's right.
Yep.
We must keep in mind that he was probably a eunuch and was therefore excluded from any religious participation in the temple. And there's a number of texts in Leviticus and Deuteronomy that speak to that. And there's a symbolism around that we won't address now. Now, a person was allowed to flee to the altar to seek asylum, but asylum was restricted to certain definite cases, and flight from a foreign enemy was not one of them, right? So it goes on to say, the whole purpose of the enemies and the false prophet was to incite him to commit a ritual transgression. This would discredit him in the eyes of his own people, and consequently, they would not be willing to cooperate with Nehemiah and finishing the wall. So, you know, if they can get Nehemiah to commit this sort of ritual transgression, then it undermines his leadership. So, I mean, it's a shrewd plan.
Yeah.
Really shrewd plan, but Nehemiah is not going to be drawn into it. I mean, and this again shows his integrity.
Yeah. And remembering, this is probably a last-ditch effort by them, because the wall's built. It's just the gates that aren't up.
Yeah.
And so they know once the gates are up, there's no way
That's
in.
Right.
And so it's like, we're just going to go all out now. We've got to deal with this. Because I think it's really important to note, this would have completely taken them by 52 days to build a wall around the entire city of Jerusalem. It was an incredible feat.
Yeah, they are. You know, it's definitely caught off guard here.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. It finishes in verse 14, closes, you know, he has this this prayer against them, you know, for trying to do this. So this is a constant theme. These prayers are important because it's constantly pointing to God. Like, he's taking this to God. He's not endlessly writing letters and complaining to the king. This is the important thing, because he's got the favor of the king.
Yeah.
But which king's favor is he constantly turning to? This is the remarkable thing about this story.
I think he realizes he's only got the favor of the king because God gave him the favor.
That's right.
King. So I'm not going to go to the middleman. I'm going to go to the top guy.
Yeah, it's really remarkable, a thing about this story. Anyway, so we're told, verse 15 is where we're told that the wall was completed in 52 days. It's an amazing achievement, as you said. Mm. And then 16, it says, when all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence, because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God.
Amazing.
And so, you know, again, you know, that note is important because he's giving credit, and the enemies have been confounded. Why? Because of the favor of God. And you know, this is them, this is that theme. I mean, you know, like, for example, through the books of the prophets, you know, and then even the enemies will know that I am God.
And that's why he kept saying, this is our God who's going to do this, not the king.
Yeah, that's right.
This is our God that's going to do this. I just want to go back before we move into chapter 7, because I think one of the other things I think that really took me here, and it was back in chapter 3, is how much Nehemiah focuses on the people that got the work done. It's not just this bit was done and that bit was done. He names the families and who worked beside who. And so there's this recognition that anyone can make a statement, we're going to do this, but it actually comes down to each person's individual contribution to make it happen.
Yeah.
You know, that sense of, we all need to carry our load. We all need to lean in and take our weight in this.
Yeah.
And to the point that Nehemiah actually goes and names all the families and who worked beside who and who did what, because it's not just about what was getting done. It was about who was sharing in that journey and that common purpose. So
just one other thing from chapter 6, is we're told about this character, Tobiah, who's an interesting character in this story. Mm. he's almost sort of serpent-like.
Yes.
You know, because he establishes these inroads inside this community. Has, you know, this foothold, to use that verse from the New Testament, you know, do not give the devil a foothold, you know, in the community. And, I mean, he's a Samaritan, but he'd, as you pointed out before, he'd married and married his son.
Into Jewish families.
Into Jewish families. Mm. So he had these sort of cunning and insidious inroads into the community, and indicates here that many were also, for some reason, under oath to him. Mm. It's almost like a bit of a godfather sort of scenario. You know, he's got these, he's got people under oath to him, so he's able to pull strings here.
And so you can understand where, how those Jewish people would have felt compromised, because much as they probably like what it is that Nehemiah is saying and doing, they're compromised because they've also made commitments to this guy Tobiah. And so what they're trying to do now is walk the line between the
that's
two,
right.
You know, and Nehemiah is going to call that out. So,
He's got these, he's still got these little, these internal problems. And I mean, there are people there that are trying to kind of reconcile Tobiah with Nehemiah, you know, trying to convince Nehemiah.
Because that's going
to
solve their problem.
That's
if
right.
If these two guys are mates, we don't have a problem anymore.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, so once the work is completed and Nehemiah's mission is accomplished, he actually, because remember, he's there only for a time, so he's got to return to the king. So he installs his brother, Hanani, as governor in his place so he can return to Susa. And look, it says, it makes a point of saying it's not just because Hanani was his brother. It's because he was a godly man, you know, and fit for this role. And actually, the fact that he initiated this delegation and went all the way back to Susa in the first place, I mean, you know, shows that this guy's got some initiative. So
totally.
Very much qualified for this job. So Nehemiah then gathers the people to draw up a census of the population. Mm. So they've kind of built the city. So the city's now walled, but
pretty scantily populated.
But but a scantily populated city is an indefensible city. It's got to be populated.
But it was also, from Nehemiah's point of view, about rebuilding the Jewish people.
The community. That's right. It's about, you've got to have a capital that's, you know, and because Jerusalem is the place also where, you know, where the temple is and the religious life is centered. So you've got to have, you know, you want to have a populated, thriving city center to help to maintain that.
Yeah.
So this isn't just politics. This is actually about building the community of faith. So the idea of the census is that, you know, he's wanting to make an equitable decision about who should be moved into the city. And this is actually the list that we then have here, because it gives us lists. We get lots of details here.
But
he basically inserts the list from Ezra chapter 2.
Would it have been Ezra that had inserted the list from Nehemiah?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
But it's the same list,
essentially. The same list.
So we get the list of the people that
were
here.
So this is where Ezra gets the list, as you say.
Yes. Yeah. And that's kind of where we'll wrap it up today, because then we move into sort of Ezra's main kind of thrust into what happens for the rest of the book of Nehemiah. But Matt, reflect on this leadership.
To me, the thing that this highlighted to me is, who do you look to? You know, he could have looked to the king. He could have, there are a number of different places he could have gone, another of levers that he could have pulled, but he just begins all the time with God. He goes to God, and the faith of this man is really, and I think this is what the text wants us to see, the faith of this man facing all of these obstacles meant that when it was all done, there's a genuine sense of celebration that God has done this and he is trustworthy and faithful.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.